Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello.
Hello, could I please speak with Wayne Kirstenbaum?
This is he.
Wayne, it is such a pleasure to have you on the phone. Thank you so much for taking the time and for being part of the quarantine tapes. Let me ask you, Wayne, what have you discovered during this time of quarantine? Perhaps, first of all, about yourself. Has the quarantine in any way, and I know it's a complicated thing to say, and I say it, with care, I should hope, has it in any way been a new way for you of living, or in another way of putting it, good for you in a sense, however terrible it is for the world?
Well, you know, Paul, I am an introvert, though I'm a talkative, big-mouthed introvert. So I love spending time by myself, but I will say that I was surprised by how I missed the incidental stimulation provided by casual contact on the streets with strangers, the kind of hum of vitality that comes with daily life, and that my mood would often plummet, say, at 4 p.m. I'd keep busy all day. And then from 4 to 6, I wouldn't have the slightest idea of what to do. But I returned to an old love of mine, figure drawing, during quarantine, because there have sprouted all over, particularly in London, for some reason, online Zoom figure drawing classes. So I sign up for these, and I'm at home in front of my computer with my pad and my ink tints, colored pencils. And there's a nude in London.
I can see you.
I'm there. I'm there with my Lyra woodless graphite stick. It's an absolute form of concentration. It's a little bit like typing somebody else's manuscript or solving a jigsaw puzzle. There's something unoriginal about figure drawing when it's trying to be simply exact. But I find it erases unpleasant thoughts.
So many things come to mind, as you can imagine, as I'm a quotomaniac by profession. I'm going to begin with this and have you react to it, because I think it might be on point. Don DeLillo said, "Sometimes I see something so moving, I know I'm not supposed to linger. See it and leave. If you stay too long, you wear out the wordless shock. Love it, trust it, and leave."
Well, that applies to every grotto and chamber of human existence. But to continue the figure drawing thread, this quote immediately struck me that the thrill of figure drawing is that the quick incidental glances that we give each other, even dear friends, what you're not supposed to stare at people. You're certainly not supposed to stare at nude people, nude strangers. But the license that figure drawing as a structure, as a kind of sacramental or ceremonial structure, the license it gives for continuous greedy looking. And what happens then is that suddenly I am struck by, say, the way the elbow touches the rib, or the curve of a wrist, or the cute stupidity of a thumb. These lines seem ecstatically beautiful all of a sudden, and I feel a kind of rapture. I mean, it sounds like overkill, but it does remind me of this in one of Elizabeth Bishop's greatest poems. I think it's 101 Illustrations in a Concordance. I think that's the title of the poem. She ends with a line, and looked our infant sight away. And that doubled verb, the looked and looked our infant sight away, I think about all the time period, but certainly when I'm drawing, that you want to multiply the instant of looking almost to go past looking.
The word infant, to my mind, is so interesting and so connected in a way also to the Don DeLillo, where he talks about the wordless shock, because infant literally means the person who doesn't have yet the phatic ability, who doesn't yet know how to speak. And then when I asked you, what are you doing? What are you doing these days? And Wayne, you seem, in a way, very, very unproductively productive, or very productive in some way. You've been delving into the Criterion collection, and particularly diving, you told me, into Godard's work, and you've been diving into him in a different way than one would, perhaps, if one had the ability to go to the movies. You've been going through his oeuvre complète, through his whole body of work. And what is Wayne Kirstenbaum attracted to? The way in Godard he severs sound and image. What on earth does that mean?
Now, I think it's the French title would be The Gay Science, but that would be the English title of it. But I can't remember now that the name of this particular Godard film, but it's one where there are moments when there's no image on screen and there's just a voice. So you have this sense through, actually, I did not steep myself in all of Godard. I watched what Criterion gave me, which were, in a sense, his more charming films up to, say, the early 70s. Though I also love his very recent work, such as The Image Book. But what struck me about Godard, and I had never been a Godard person, is that he sounds so corny, Paul, but he reinvented the language of cinema in such a thorough way, in the way that I think Ashbery reinvented poetic language, that regardless of whether or not one is moved by his plots or the personae that populate his films, his treatment, his rigorous treatment of all the elements of cinematic language, it's a kind of surgical dismemberment of the equipment of sound and image, with a lot of glamour and color and wish to shock the viewer or alienate the viewer in that kind of way that Stein always wished to do. And I always love artists who make things difficult.
I want you to unpack that a little bit, because the virtues of difficulty, as connected perhaps to this moment in time, where during this whole quarantine time, we have been doing these quarantine tapes, a theme comes back, Wayne, again and again, which is the theme of slowness, taking things at a different pace, a different rhythm, because we can.
Yeah, what it reminds me of is that my speed of reading has slowed down. I'm embarrassed to say this in public as an intellectual or a professor or whatever, a writer. I shouldn't say that. My appetite for the written word has not abated or dimmed. It's as if that my tempo of absorption has slowed down. So the thing I find very consoling, Paul, is to make sure before I go to bed that I read one poem by somebody else. I read a poem. I have various books of poetry by my bed. Maybe I'll cheat and read three. Maybe I'll read a whole book of poems. But I want to make sure that I read one. These poems never enter my dreams for some reason. I always feel that moment before going to bed is my last chance to make something good of my life. And it sounds melodramatic, but I feel it's a death moment going to bed. So maybe before the quarantine, I would have read books in the day and all that. I have this need, this urgent sense that right before bed, I have to read a poem, and maybe that's all the reading I need to do that day.
Well, of course, what comes to my mind is to ask you to perhaps read or recite, because I know you know a lot of things by heart, but to perhaps read one such poem. But before you do, I have to tell you of a story that I probably have told before, and perhaps here, which is I had occasion to speak with W.S. Merwin as he was on his way to becoming the poet laureate. He stopped in New York. And I said to him from the stage at the New York Public Library, I said, you know, I don't read very much poetry anymore. I used to when I was in Europe. There was a whole year devoted to poetry. One called it l'année de poésie, the year of poetry. But I don't, and I said it, you know, guiltily. And he said, Paul, you have it all wrong. Don't read poetry. Read poems.
Wise Merwin, wise, luminous man. We could talk for hours, Paul, about his line endings, his just like way of putting a line on the page and what it says about the environment and silence and pausing so much. But if the poem that I want to read to you, and it's aimed at you in a way, Paul, very specifically, because by birth and many reasons, more European than I am, we share something of the German-French connection together, among other influences and atmospheres we share. So, as I might have mentioned, I read this fall Rosanna Warren's huge and magisterial biography of Max Jacob, which I had been awaiting for years, because he's a writer I care very much about. So I wanted to read you a very short poem from Le Cornet à Day. I only have here with me in my apartment the English translation of it, I'm afraid, translated by William Kulik, K-U-L-I-K. The poem is a prose poem, and it's called My Life. The town to be captured is in a room. The spoils aren't heavy, and the enemy won't carry them off, because it doesn't need any money, since this is a story, and only a story. The town has painted wood ramparts. We cut them out and paste them in our book. There are two chapters, or parts. Here's a red king with a gold crown climbing onto a saw. That's chapter two. As for chapter one, I can't remember it. That's it.
That's it. And what speaks to you in it particularly? And did you read it one such night before falling asleep?
I will tonight reread that. I wanted to bring Max Jacob in for our conversation. What draws me to all of his work, but particularly this poem, is its humility, that it approaches the sanctuary or the podium of poetry, a daunting thing to approach, with a sense that, of course, he will fail at this or be too much of a buffoon for the task. So there's a kind of clown-like renunciation of the gravity of poetry that informs this. And there's even what, and I love this so much about his work, and also about Robert Walser's work, is the inclusion in the poem or in the story, often at its end, a statement of embarrassed shirking of the task of even being responsible for this little poem that I just gave to you. So there's a disappearance act within the poem. It's the wish to write the poem is strong, but the poem that comes out will declare the insufficiency of the equipment. And that statement of insufficiency creates a kind of transcendence.
During this time of quarantine, with the difficulty of being in contact with other people, and living in New York City as you do, what are the moments for you where serendipity is possible, or serendipity is a possibility? Because I think of you, and you said it sort of at the beginning, it isn't the intimate relationship you may be looking for when you meander, but it is the incidental relationship which actually might jolt you equally.
Sometimes I'm in upstate New York in Germantown, where I may not even leave the house all day. So then there's no contact except by Zoom, which is its own subject. But in New York, in my modest meanderings, I have a habit at the end of the day to enumerate the specific glancing encounters that I had. And I would say, in the elevator, I rode the elevator with this person and we said that. I went to the pool and spoke to the lifeguard. I went to this gallery and there was a young person at the desk who asked if who took my temperature. You know, and the little, and then lo and behold, I went to the grocery store and I saw a neighbor near the kale. So, and that those things, those encounters that go without saying almost become, in fact, the valued parts of a day.
You know, I also think when I think about you, I mean, I think about so many things, so many aspects, so many passions, so many obsessions, so many encounters. But I think when I think particularly about your writing, I think about your love, I take it, for allegory. And to quote Jan Morris in her most splendid book, we just lost Jan Morris, who I so deeply loved. She talks about, in her book about Trieste and the meaning of nowhere, she says, she talks about the weakness for allegory. And she says, those of us who have a weakness for allegory, that is to say, as the Austrian Robert Musil once put it, those of us who suppose everything to mean more than it has any honest claim to mean. How does that strike you?
Well, I love it. I want to be identified with allegory. And a line that I live by, and I think it's Freud. In fact, it is Freud, and I've probably quoted it in another one of our many conversations over the years, is a footnote in The Interpretation of Dreams, where Freud essentially says that we are justified in over-interpreting the details of this dream. In fact, we are required to over-interpret them. And this rage for interpretation past the bounds of reasonableness or common sense, I take as a calling, and I guess what the allegorical impulse in this case is the insistence that things symbolize, that pictures have captions, many captions. And I think this is the opposite, though, I have a sort of surrealist notion of allegory. I don't think you have to have the right captions or the right symbolic relations. I think you can have an accidental one, and maybe that one is more illuminating. But I think it's the gesture of making the leap toward the thing or the event, making the leap upward toward its significance that is, well, it's a healing leap. And it's a way to manufacture energy in your body and brain by making that leap and making it a practice of, you know, going allegorical on the world, saying, you know, I'm gonna go allegorical. I'm not supposed to. Which is not the same as lying or deceiving people or retreating from consensual sense and social contracts. Not at all.
During this time also of quarantine, Wayne, I think you've been listening to a lot of music and playing a lot of music, which you've always done, but this time perhaps has offered you a different time frame in which to exercise that passion. And I'm wondering if you might tell us what this moment has afforded you in terms of discoveries, rediscoveries, music you might want to evoke, music you might want to talk about.
Yes, well, I love talking about music. I'll say a couple of quick things. I had been taking voice lessons for a few years in conjunction with this lounge act I do, though I'm not a gifted or a born singer by any means. But I nonetheless had been taking serious voice lessons. Those got interrupted by the pandemic. Just sudden, a lesson got canceled, and that was in March. So for the first few months of the pandemic, I sang a lot, and I would had my Fauré songs, my Scarlatti, very ambitious repertoire, I must say, Schubert, even a little Strauss, making, you know, so I would sing and I would feel a sense of accomplishment. No one in the world knew this, but I'd say I sang 3 Schubert songs today, and I sang a Kurt Weill song. And it would be like a kind of invisible concert that I had given. I suppose my partner heard it, but I'd only do it when he was out of the house because I don't want other people necessarily to hear that. But on the piano, I decided that I would read the Beethoven sonatas in order, page movement by movement. I didn't finish. I think I chickened out like the 25th sonata, and my bookmark is still there, and I can continue. And I did the second book of the Well-Tempered Clavier in order, et cetera. But I also, my CD player, I still have CDs, my CD player broke. And so I couldn't listen to music. So I had to, I ordered a little Bluetooth speaker and I got the Spotify app, which I had always detested the very notion of. And it's not really that good for classical music, but so I just tried other things and I would go on exploring missions, like kind of Google rabbit hole experiences. And I discovered things that I never would have been exposed to, such as all sorts of reggae. I'd been reading a book about Jamaican sound systems called Sonic Bodies. And so I was interested to listen to reggae and ska and rock steady. And I fell in love with many, particularly 60s and early 70s Jamaican musicians. The song that really sent me was a little ditty called Life by Bob, written by, I believe, but also sung by Bob Andy. It was a hit in the UK in the early 70s, and it's a real pop tune. I'm not a dancer anymore than I'm really a singer, but listening to this tune, I would feel compelled to do a little kind of dance in front of the mirror. I could predictably brighten my glum tropic mood, my dolorous tropic mood, by listening to this song. He died, I think, just last year in March. So, by the way, Bob Andy.
So Spotify, in a way, has been good despite the dread, because it's permitted perhaps not a real flânerie as we know it, but serendipity of a certain kind.
Well, we know this, Paul, through Twitter, among other places. There are venues and apps and media in our current life that are, it's in some way, evil. I mean, that there's something, I don't know if I would plan a good universe, that I would plan for a universe that had Twitter or Spotify. There's a lot of form. There's a lot of things to be said against those sorts of monopolization and monetization of attention. And we know those arguments. Nonetheless, if you are a flaneur, you can do your flaneuring on those apps. And there are friendships to build, aesthetic discoveries to make. And Spotify, you know, it, as opposed to like buying an LP or a CD and assiduously listening to it and then going and buying another one, I can just say, I'm doing Carmen McRae today. And then realize I never gave Carmen McRae the credit she deserved as the preeminent dissector of syllable from syllable in a word. Just, she freaks out the language that she's given in these song lyrics. I mean, I could go on and on about Carmen McRae. And that's a spot I knew about her, but I hadn't delved as deeply into Carmen McRae. I think there's even something I listened to that's Betty Carter and Carmen McRae singing live together in San Francisco, and they go crazy with this kind of dismembering game on language, where every word every syllable is pushed in a syncopated and estranging direction.
Was there something today on Spotify you discovered this very day?
This very day, no. But I will say that very recently, I'm really falling in love with vibraphone. And the great vibraphone players in jazz history, the first two big ones were Lionel Hampton and Milt Jackson. And the timbre of a vibraphone, I find the most enchanting thing. It's not unlike a gamelan in a sense. It has staying power and sustaining power, but also the ping, and the sense of being slightly not human, but also human. And so just yesterday I watched on YouTube Lionel Hampton playing the vibes on American TV in 1959, and it's incredible. The dexterity, the rhythmic accuracy, and in a way the translation of human energy through the sieve of the vibraphone, almost a mechanical sieve, into some other purified timbre that is celestial, disembodied, kind of sci-fi. Are you a vibraphone lover by any chance, Paul?
You know, I have listened to Lionel Hampton a long, long time ago because I have a passion for jazz. I think that my greatest passion, and having spoken here with on the Quarantine Tapes with Sonny Rollins, I'm he's 90 and lucid. Can I tell you one thing he said that I'll never forget? I asked him if he was influenced by Coleman Hawkins, who he met when he was 7 years old. And you know, the question of influence, I'm sure that you discuss this when you teach and think about it all the time, because you are haunted by so many ghosts, I believe, Wayne. So I asked him, you know, would it make any sense to say that you were influenced by Coleman Hawkins, who really brought the saxophone in a way to the language of jazz? And his response was, I hope so.
Wow. Coleman Hawkins, there are many, many moods. This is pre-quarantine, but there are many, many moods that can only be met, my moods, that can only be met by Coleman, the sound of Coleman Hawkins, which seems to make, in some sense, very few demands, as opposed to Thelonious Monk. The interface, the membrane between me, the listener, and Coleman Hawkins, the player, there's almost like no membrane. It's just the transfer of information or of affect goes seamlessly into me because of something kind of cushioned about his attack. Maybe this isn't true of everything that he did, and I have a sort of the CDs that I've been listening to, April in Paris, Body and Soul, are unusually honeyed. But there's something about the sense of impressionist mist and almost miasma. There's a mood. I'm so grateful for his the gentleness of the approach of his articulated notes.
There's something I loved that Parul Sigal said about figuring out. She did a beautiful review of your book, published maybe a year ago now, or maybe not quite. She spoke about all the various people you have learned from. We know Sonny Rollins may have had Coleman Hawkins in the background always of his playing. And you learned from many people. But she says that you learned from Montaigne randomness and decisiveness. I'd love you to comment on her comment about you learning that from them, and how those two words that seem so tense with each other might go together.
I will say, by being like Proust on reading, which we share the love of, that essay, I will say, when I read Montaigne most deeply in English, I confess, I was in France, staying on vacation in the Dordogne in a town called Tremolat for a week in a rented little cottage, and I had the thick, I think, Penguin Montaigne, and I would read it. It was the book I read, and I remember very specifically at night before bed reading his essay, Montaigne's essay, I believe, on Virgil. It's a famous essay of his, and a very long one, and it seems like not the essay I would want to read on vacation, Montaigne on Virgil, but I remember it being the dirtiest or the most lewd of all the essays in the book, and that it had much in it that was not Virgil. I hope I'm remembering this essay correctly, but so I loved, you know, I can say, I never think of myself as being influenced by Montaigne, but I will take, I did take from him the sense that you could land in your ideation, in your thinking, you could land on whatever you happen to land on, because your mind is going to land there. You can't make your mind land places that it doesn't want to land. The mind has a terrible, forceful will. And you just have to, once you land there, you have to make something of it. And so maybe you're landing on a particular thing, the way I just landed in a way on Tremolat, is arbitrary and not intrinsically meaningful, but you can, if you linger a little bit too long there, you can make something of it. And I believe very much that it's our duty, when we see art or see anything, including, you know, other people, to make ourselves excited by it. That we don't, you can't wait to be excited. You have to make yourself excited, and you can make yourself excited by taking that kind of leap of this, what, you know, we talked earlier, the symbolic or the allegorical leap, which Montaigne, you know, the Montaigne method is go somewhere, turn, make a sharp right turn, park your car, and create a cosmology right there where you are.
You know, it brings to mind this wonderful line of J.D. Salinger, who said, "I like when somebody gets excited about something. It's nice." And it's, yeah, it's that you seek, Wayne.
Yeah. And it's why I never really liked the practice of the kind of the journalism criticism, journalistic criticism or reviews, which presuppose that the function of criticism is to judge and evaluate, which is a real function, and I acknowledge the need for that. Much more important is to cultivate our ability to be excited by even by mediocre art. We don't want to spend our whole time, our whole lives marooned there, but you know, we have a kind of obligation, I think, to maximize the pleasure and delight we get out of our lives. And let's say, to return to the quarantine topic, which is ever present for us, that trying to manufacture enthusiasm through diligence, habits, forcefulness, willpower, humility, you know, that is a daily task for us now.
It's amazing that you brought back the quarantine. I was going to say now in closing that it is delightful to talk to you about these kinds of peregrinations in this complicated time, because these kinds of peregrinations in these complicated times are also the stuff our lives and days are made of. And in a way, they help us. They're nearly palliatives for what we are missing.
Indeed, and much of human history, including the history that Max Jacob lived through, was very complicated.
Wayne, on that word of complication, we spoke about difficulty and the pleasures thereof. I bid you farewell, and I hope there will come a time very soon where we will again be able to see each other in person. But until such a time, thank you so very, very much, Wayne, and take precious care.
You too, Paul. Love talking to you.
All the best. Bye-bye. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.